See, I don't have a quorum, do I?
No.
You, them, Pete, Marie. Members, we've got to make a few motions, but we won't make them until we have a quorum. So I think what we'll do is we'll just pass the president. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Ruffino.
To the committee, and why don't you just start off, and then I'll just do some procedural things that might interrupt you, or when you're done, we'll do what we have to do to get these,
right,
some of our bills moving. Welcome. Call the meeting order.
Thank you, Chair Ruffino, members of the committee. It's wonderful to be with you and have the opportunity to present the university's 2008 capital request. Before I proceed with the details of the request, I would like to introduce members of the university's Board of Regents who are with us this afternoon. Patricia Simmons, who is the chair of the university's Board of Regents. Regents is behind me. The vice chair of the board, Clyde Allen, is with us today. Dallas Lonsock, Stephen Hunter, Linda Cohen, and Venora Hung. And I want to thank them for joining us. I think they have my back, Chair Ruffino.
Well, I should publicly apologize to Lenora because I think I scared her down in Rochester. I didn't really mean it. Don't take offense. It's an old Croatian thing. Memoi nisi zamiriti. Don't take offense at anything I said. So. Go ahead, Mr.
Well, you scared the devil out of me on the range last week.
Yeah, really.
I'm hoping I'll do better today. I want to start with a quote from one of our most esteemed alumni. A graduate of the university, alumnus Garrison Keeler, who once referred to the University of Minnesota as one of the glories of our state. I think it is. The university has 5 campuses, more than 30 research and outreach centers throughout the state, regional extension offices, and a lot of other critical locations as well. And these resources have a tremendous impact on Minnesota's economy, Minnesota's prosperity, Minnesota's quality of life. These locations serve more than, we estimate, 100,000 faculty, staff, students, and guests daily, citizens of our state. These locations are the home of more than $600 million of competitively secured grants and contracts and outside funding, most of which comes from outside the state of Minnesota to fund research and innovation. And it's also a place where we host outreach activities to really link the benefits of research and education to the needs of Minnesota communities, outreach activities that reach more than 1 million Minnesotans on an annual basis. One of the rewards of my job, and I mean this most sincerely, is the opportunity to travel throughout the state of Minnesota as I did on the Iron Range in the past couple of weeks, and to have the opportunity to talk to Minnesotans about their aspirations for the future. I'm always amazed when I make these trips and deeply gratified with the passion of Minnesotans when they talk about their University of Minnesota. They feel a real sense of pride and ownership in the university, and I think they feel a real pride and sense of ownership regarding the quality and the reach of higher education throughout our state. This feeling is nothing new in Minnesota. Our state's founding fathers and mothers had such a strong passion for higher education that just 2 years after Minnesota became a territory and 7 years before we became a state, they chartered the University of Minnesota. And I find that one of the most inspiring chapters in Minnesota's history. In those early days, Governor John Sargent Pillsbury remarked, "There is no factor that can do more for the state and the nation than the university, with its wide open doors ever welcoming all to enter." Governor Pillsbury's vision is the same today, that all people are enriched by understanding and that the university bears a deep public responsibility to advance that understanding, to advance innovation, education, our economy, our quality of life. If I sound like I'm a cheerleader, I truly get paid to do it, but it's no accident. I think the university truly makes a difference, a profound difference, each and every day. all of you know that we've been trying to set very audacious goals for the future of the University of Minnesota. Goals that we think will lift us academically, improve the quality of education for our students and the outcomes of our students, improve the productivity and service of the University of Minnesota. But accomplishing these aspirations and goals, in my judgment, requires not just an aggressive plan, but it demands a shared sense of responsibility with you, the state of Minnesota. And we simply can't succeed in our mission and what we're trying to accomplish on behalf of Minnesota without strong state support. This year's capital investment, I think one of the most critical we have placed before you in many years, builds on past investments, the generosity of this state towards the University of Minnesota. It builds on historic strength, and it also proactively, in a very thoughtful way, addresses some serious weaknesses in the University of Minnesota's infrastructure. We have some of the oldest and historically most significant buildings in the entire state of Minnesota. We're the home of more than 800 buildings. That is, we manage 800 buildings covering nearly 30 million square feet throughout the state of Minnesota. The Twin Cities campus alone has 250 buildings, 25% of which are more than 70 years old. I believe we must preserve and protect these valuable and historic resources, in addition to providing the infrastructure to enhance our research, education, and outreach capacities, and we need strong, predictable state investment to do so. I want to make the point that what you're going to see today is not a set of disconnected, isolated capital projects. They represent the continuation of a long-term vision regarding the future of the University of Minnesota, a vision that we think is important to enhance the quality of our state. We take real pride in the capital planning process of the University of Minnesota. It's rigorous, it's data-oriented, it, in my judgment, practices the best, it exemplifies the best practices that you will find in higher education today. Each of the projects that we're going to talk with you about today was formulated over a six-year period, measured very carefully against our mission of research, education, and public engagement, also had the benefit of very rigorous review to assess the condition of the facilities that we're going to discuss with you today. To make things a little easier, and I hope a little bit more interesting for you, we decided to cut the next 25 minutes of my remarks and instead put them on a video clip. And so I'd like to present the essence, I guess, the real heart of the university's 2008 capital request at this time with the benefit of technology. I made the mistake at one of our meetings of saying, roll the tape, and one of the younger members of the board said, you should say, run the clip. So let's run the clip.
Mr. Chair, can you hold this for a Mr. President, I've got to move to approve some minutes. So
okay.
I think I'll have Representative Severson, who was up on the range with us, move the minutes of the June 28th meeting of 2007 in Mountain Iron.
So moving.
Yes, and any additions or corrections? We had a great time up there. And the university came and helped us out, which we really appreciate. Do you have that money, that request in here anywhere for that money for that mesothelioma study, Mr. President?
Not at this time, but I probably could get it ready in about 5 minutes.
We're working on it.
If there was a chance of getting it funded here this afternoon.
Any additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, motion prevails. And then Representative Detmer moves minutes from Tuesday's meeting. Any additions or corrections to that, member? If not, all of the favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Sorry, go ahead, Mr. Stoney. Roll them.
Okay. Run the clip.
Wow. You have so many buildings. How do they take care of them all?
The University of Minnesota has more than 800 buildings across the state, and we have some of the oldest buildings. On the Twin Cities campus alone, there are more than 250 buildings. 25% of them are more than 70 years old. That's a lot to take care of, and we take our stewardship responsibilities very seriously. Vice President O'Brien will explain how we use HEPR funds. That stands for Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement to maintain our buildings.
Hi, I'm Kathleen O'Brien, the Vice President of University Services. It's my job to make sure that the university buildings support our teaching, research, and outreach. This building, Coffee Hall, is in the 2008 HEPR request. It needs waterproofing and tuck pointing. We're preserving the structural integrity of this 101-year-old building so that it will last another 100 years. Every day I think about creating a safe campus for our students, faculty, and staff, and buildings that are well-maintained, function efficiently, and don't put our people at risk. Like this elevator in a 5-story research building, the St. Anthony Falls Laboratory. That can't be operated without making a special arrangement. And it's a point of pride to me to be able to preserve historic buildings by giving them a new modern purpose while maintaining their historic integrity. Back to the question. We expect about 7 to 8 million square feet each year on the Twin Cities campus, and from those inspections, we've created a database of the conditions of all of the buildings on the Twin Cities campus. We update this database annually, and we have the same program on all of our other campuses. It's a lot of buildings to keep track of and a lot of money to take care of them. It would cost about $7 billion to replace all the buildings throughout the University of Minnesota. That's why it's important to me and to the state to take care of what we have, and that's what HEPR funds do.
As you've heard from Vice President O'Brien, our buildings provide mission-critical space for our faculty, staff, students, and visitors. Past generations have made investments in the U, and it's our responsibility, in partnership with the state, to maintain the value of those investments for generations to come.
I took Chemistry 1001 in this building in 1974. I took Introductory Calculus in this building in 1987.
I took Geology 1001 in this building in 2005.
I took Organic Chemistry in this building in 2004.
I took Physics in this building in 1985.
I took Physical Chemistry in this building in 2003.
Why is this building still here?
The university is the state's premier source of human capital and innovation, which are critical to state economic growth and national competitiveness. Core Minnesota industries, including health, medical devices, technology, and roughly 400 food companies, depend on an educated, scientifically literate workforce, basic and applied research, and new ideas generated here at the university. As a nation, however, we are falling behind. Policymakers and employers are calling for more graduates in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and there's growing consensus that new ways of teaching science are required.
Hi, I'm Mary Costin, director of the One Stop Student Services Center. I'd like to see this building replaced too. Over the years, we've greatly improved our student services like registration, financial aid, and advising. Most routine transactions can now be completed online, but students and parents often prefer face-to-face conversations with professional counselors and advisors. We'd like to consolidate in-person student services in one location on this site. This location has one of the highest concentrations of pedestrian traffic on campus. We can enhance the student experience by centralizing services in the new Science Teaching and Student Services Center. Services like career counseling, advising for students in transition, and student leadership that are now scattered across campus. The new building will provide an ideal location to serve two major functions, a space for new state-of-the-art classroom facilities for basic science teaching, and a home for a consolidated student services center.
Hi, I'm Robin Wright, Associate Dean in the College of Biological Sciences and Professor of Genetics, Cell Biology, and Development. We envision a new way to teach science at the University of Minnesota. Research shows that student-centered, inquiry-based teaching methods increase student retention in the sciences. These classroom approaches also promote deeper learning and help students develop the critical skills they'll need for successful careers and life as engaged citizens of their community, state, and nation. After all, scientists work in a collaborative, technology-rich environment, and that's the kind of environment we want to create in a new building, the Science Teaching and Student Services Center. I'm sitting in a prototype of the type of classroom that will be in this new building, a classroom with flexible learning space that supports increased student interactions in a technology-rich, multimedia environment. These new high-tech, high-touch learning spaces will help us provide our students with the up-to-date, high-quality education they must have to thrive in an increasingly competitive, global scientific community.
Northern Minnesota needs more civil engineers. What is the University of Minnesota Duluth going to do for us?
The work of civil engineers is critical to our economy and quality of life. They plan, design, construct, and operate the structures that are essential to modern life. From bridges and highway systems to water treatment plants and energy-efficient buildings, civil engineers enhance the way we live by addressing issues including traffic congestion, urban sprawl, pollution, and sustainability.
Hello, I'm Catherine Martin, Chancellor of the University of Minnesota Duluth. We have recently announced the addition of a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering. This degree has been added in direct response to area industries and public agencies that have expressed a great need for engineers in northeastern Minnesota. The first class will start in the fall of 2008 and will enroll 200 students within 4 years, graduating 35 to 40 civil engineers on an annual basis. Minnesota students, as well as local industries, have expressed a great deal of interest in the necessity of having an additional civil engineering degree in the state of Minnesota. Currently, the state is losing prospective engineering students to other states. We can help prevent this brain drain with our graduates who will provide key skills to support mining and other industries in our region. This building houses mechanical, chemical, and industrial engineering programs. Together, these programs will lead to a more stable and comprehensive foundation for civil engineering programs in northern Minnesota.
UMD's civil engineering program is a natural complement to existing engineering programs. It will contribute to a healthy and viable environment and economy for northern Minnesota. This building addition will ensure that UMD will be able to provide a quality, hands-on education and fill the need for civil engineers for years to come.
As the mayor of Morris, I'm interested in how to keep small towns in rural Minnesota vital. How do I access the University of Minnesota Morris's education, research, and expertise?
Consistently named one of the nation's top public liberal arts colleges, the University of Minnesota Morris is a prime example of our three-part mission: a world-class liberal arts education in a small college environment, groundbreaking research in renewable energy, and award-winning examples of campus community engagement. Chancellor Jacqueline Johnson will tell you more.
My name is Jackie Johnson, and I'm honored to be the Chancellor at the University of Minnesota Morris, part of the vibrant community that is Morris in this west central part of Minnesota. There are so many ways in which the university and the community have partnered. I'm standing here in Big Cat Stadium, which just opened last year and is a partnership between the university and the community. Morris Area High School Tigers and the University of Minnesota Cougars play football in this stadium. Behind me is the Regional Fitness Center, which is an early example of this partnership. The Center for Small Towns at the University of Minnesota Morris is a national example of public engagement. In fact, we won last year the Carter Community Partnership Award to exemplify the good work that we have done over the last 10 years in creating an alliance between the university and the community. My vision for this campus includes increased enrollment, even stronger partnerships with the community and with the region, and our strategic plan calls on us to be energy self-sufficient by the year 2010. We imagine the existing community services building as a gateway to the campus. We also imagine this building as a home for the Center for Small Towns. We also expect to renovate this building in such a way that we will preserve the past at the same time that we continue to promote the green effects that are part of the developing, distinguishing characteristics of the University of Minnesota Morris.
And that's another way the University of Minnesota Morris is a strong regional partner. The first large-scale wind research turbine ever constructed at a U.S. public university began generating power here in March 2005. It powers half of the campus building and returns the excess power to Otter Tail Power Company. And a soon-to-be-completed biomass project will burn agricultural waste from the region, like corn silver, injecting hundreds of thousands of dollars into the local economy, all while conserving energy, reducing greenhouse gases, and creating educational opportunities for students.
Wow! Those dioramas at the Bell Museum are really cool. I wonder what's going to be in the new Bell Museum.
The Bell Museum is Minnesota's official natural history museum. Established by statute in 1872, the Bell Museum collects, preserves, and displays our state's animal and plant life for research, teaching, and public enjoyment. It is one of the country's premier research-based science museums. In fact, the Bell scientific collections were instrumental in saving the peregrine falcon. The Bell is truly a living research museum that serves our community in a very unique way, making the university's work in the biological, environmental, social, and physical sciences come alive for literally thousands of visitors of all ages each year. I'll let our museum director tell you more.
Hi, I'm Scott Lanyon, director of the Bell Museum of Natural History. The university is in the final stages of preparing plans for a new museum facility on the St. Paul campus. The new facility will be the gateway to the St. Paul campus, and visitors will have easy access not only to the Bell Museum, but to the Raptor Center, Equine Center, the Bee Lab, greenhouses, and the Display Garden, all great places to visit. The building we're in now was built in the 1930s. At that time, natural history museums were focused on preserving the past, and the Bell Museum does that as well with its world-famous habitat dioramas. These dioramas will be preserved in the new facility we're building on the St. Paul campus. In the new museum, we'll create interactive displays and exhibits that inspire inquiry and bring people closer to their natural world. Young and old alike can learn from the state's largest collection documenting Minnesota's biodiversity. The new Bell Museum will be an exciting place to visit. We'll include indoor and outdoor exhibit space, gallery space for traveling exhibits and dioramas, an auditorium, and classroom and community space. The 12-acre site will be landscaped to represent Minnesota's three ecosystems, prairie, Northwoods coniferous forest, and maple basswood deciduous forest, and will contain interactive exhibits. The building and landscape will be designed to attract wildlife and will include trails, ponds, observation posts, and a range of nesting sites. And we'll incorporate sustainable building design in the new building. We've already done some planning in this end. In fact, we won the highly competitive Kresge Foundation Green Building Grant to develop these plans. It's exciting to look forward to that first day in the new building when we can continue the museum's decades-long tradition of educating Minnesota's teachers, students, and indeed anyone with a thirst to learn about the natural world.
De qué forma la universidad está preparando a los estudiantes para la economía global?
Falwell Hall, in the historic Knoll District of the Minneapolis campus, is 100 years old. It was named for William Watts Falwell, the first president of the university at a time when the university had 8 faculty and fewer than 100 students. Falwell envisioned the university as a cultural center of the state, and today, his namesake building is home to nearly 300 instructional staff and more than 1,000 majors in its 5 departments in the College of Liberal Arts. I'll let some of our faculty tell you more.
Hi, I'm Laura Burak, a professor and chair of the Department of Writing Studies at the university. This new department was created as a result of strategic positioning, a long-term plan for the University of Minnesota to become one of the top public research universities in the world. A commitment to exceptional education is a cornerstone of this plan, and the ability to write is central to a quality education. Our goal is for every university graduate in every major to be able to write in a logical, understandable way. It's what we want, and it's what employers want for our graduates. The university-wide baccalaureate writing initiative will be housed in a renovated Falwell Hall. Every single undergraduate on the Twin Cities campus, nearly 29,000 students, will use this building. Every freshman will be required to take writing. So, it's vital that we renovate this building and its learning environments to be flexible, adaptable, and up to university standards in order to provide the best education we can for our students.
Hi, I'm Ana Paula Ferreira, a professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese Studies. I'm standing in the Language Center of Johns Hall, renovated in 2005. This center has all the latest instructional technology and resources to assist faculty and students in second language teaching and learning. Falwell Hall is right next door, and my department will be housed there along with many other language departments. Language instruction is increasingly important in today's world, and the university is utilizing new techniques to ensure our graduates have the language skills and cultural literacy to be successful. New classrooms in Falwell Hall will allow us to better prepare our students for a rapidly globalizing world. More than 30 languages are taught at the university, 19 in Falwell Hall alone. We envision Falwell Hall becoming a multilingual and multicultural hub for students, with space that supports and enhances learning rather than what we have today. After all, language and writing are essential in a global economy.
Our vision for Falwell Hall befits its namesake, an historic signature building that serves students and the state by educating global citizens with effective communication skills across disciplines and cultures.
How does the university's request for buildings improve my education?
The quality of the education students receive at the U is of utmost importance to all of us and is directly affected by the learning environment. The university has about 300 general-purpose classrooms used for teaching in many different disciplines. These classrooms are spread across 55 buildings on the Twin Cities campus and accommodate 22,000 students each hour of the class day. For several years, the university has been upgrading classrooms with the latest technology and improved facilities. These upgrades are essential in providing the quality teaching and learning environment that faculty and students need.
Hi, I'm Gary Ballas, professor of aerospace engineering mechanics at the U. My department is housed in Ackerman Hall. The classroom I'm standing in is outdated and inflexible. As you can see, the windows are single pane, there's poor lighting, uneven heating, and no ventilation. And it's not handicap accessible. This classroom is one of nine that would be renovated in this building. The biggest limitation is that there are poor learning spaces that are lacking in technology and physical attributes that we need in today's active learning classrooms. We're not meeting the needs of faculty or the expectations of students as we prepare them to work and conduct research in a collaborative, technology-rich environment. It's our goal to provide students the highest quality education at the University of Minnesota. To do that, our classrooms need to keep pace with the dynamic teaching and learning needs of faculty and students. By investing in classrooms, we're investing in our students and our future.
It's important to know that it has taken us a number of years to get where we are today. Classroom improvement is a hallmark of good stewardship at the university.
What's the university doing to stay competitive in research?
Hi, I'm Tim Mulcahy, Vice President for Research. The University of Minnesota is one of the nation's premier public research universities. In 2006, our faculty brought in $570 million in research grants and contracts, and we expect that number to be more than $600 million in 2007. We've been credited with four of the world's top academic innovations with real-world applications, including treatments for HIV, purifying water supplies for the developing world, treating equine metabolic disorders, and preventing swine pandemics, which would be catastrophic to the state's pork industry. Great research depends on world-class researchers. In order for the university to recruit and retain the world's best, we need to be able to offer them facilities like this in which to do their work. New facilities like these in the Cargill building are typical of the quality needed everywhere. With new buildings like this, we have been successful in recruiting world-class researchers at the cutting and competitive edge of their fields. We've also been able to retain many researchers who otherwise would have been lured away by offers including great facilities elsewhere. Some of our faculty, however, struggle to maintain research programs in old buildings, like Calvert Lab, built in 1958 to 1958 research standards. Such antiquated facilities make it difficult to compete in an increasingly competitive research environment. Many old laboratories need utility upgrades to handle modern instrumentation. Some require renovations to accommodate changes in federal research regulations, while still others need installation of new biological containment systems and rebuilt ventilation systems. All are modern research necessities. Much like our approach in updating classrooms throughout our campuses, we need to make targeted strategic investments to improve facilities to support research in areas like food and nutrition, veterinary medicine, health sciences, and engineering. Modern laboratories make all the difference in our ability to attract the best and brightest faculty and students. Through the resulting increase in competitiveness and productivity, structured investments in our research infrastructure will pay dividends for years and generations to come.
I know what teaching is, and I know what research is, but how does the university do outreach?
The University of Minnesota faculty and staff connect to the community in so many ways and in so many locations. Partnerships with school districts, regional extension offices, and the Landscape Arboretum, to name just a few. The university's six research and outreach centers are set up to respond to regional needs, to bring university research to bear in achieving practical solutions for specific community needs. Each center forges strong partnerships and works to connect local communities to the university's expertise.
I'm Larry Smith. I'm the head of the Northwest Research and Outreach Center located in Crookston, Minnesota. The focus of our center is agricultural research and outreach. More than 50 researchers lead hundreds of research projects relevant to Northwest Minnesota, like sugar beets where we are now and wheat research. Northwest Minnesota has the largest gross farm income from crop production of anywhere in the state. The center is well connected to area farmers and provides them with the research and education they need in their day-to-day operations. The research center also serves as a training ground for students in agricultural programs at the University of Minnesota Crookston. Our research and educational programs are intimately connected to the economic vitality of this great region of Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Al Levine, Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences. Agriculture in Minnesota is diverse, and the West Central Research and Outreach Center responds to this diversity by addressing issues related to the broad range of agricultural systems in the region, like livestock raising and swine production, and the environmental impact of those activities, like water quality. Working with farmers, rural leaders, and citizens, we stay connected to the varied and changing needs of the producers and citizens of Minnesota. Working together in partnership is our greatest strength. The West Central Research and Outreach Center also houses the Hughes Renewable Energy Research and Demonstration Center. Research is focused on wind, biomass, biofuels, and renewable hydrogen. It's our goal to provide a model for rural communities and ag producers who want to incorporate renewable energy systems and to inform the state's renewable energy industry. Renewable energy is poised to become an important part of our state and nation's energy future, and the West Central Research and Outreach Center will be a leader in this work.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to just close with a few comments on our capital request, highlighted by this video clip. You'll see it, the financial plan in front of you. This plan asks for capital investment of $288 million with a request of $225 million to the state of Minnesota. The request you're considering, and the university would be responsible under this plan for approximately $63 million of the cost. We think this is a really sound plan. It's a plan that makes investments in critical infrastructure needs of the University of Minnesota across the state of Minnesota, and it's vitally important to support the students, faculty, and staff who do the vital work that our university provides to the state. I really urge you to consider this request. We really need your help. All of higher education needs your investment, and I think, quite honestly, this is the right time to invest in capital assets, and I don't think we'll have a set of circumstances quite like the ones we have now. We have clear infrastructure needs. We also have declining infrastructure, and we have a very, very favorable environment to address it with interest rates and the employment picture we find statewide. So I urge you to give this request every possible consideration. Be happy to take your questions at this time, and certainly we'll be available throughout the session to answer your questions and to work with you.
Members, what I'm going to do here before we take questions, is Representative Grimes still in there? Representative Grimes, I think you have a meeting at 1:30. Would you want to come down and just do a quick presentation on your bill? And because, members, while she's coming down, we also have Representative Bly's bill that I don't think is on the priority list. Maybe you can do a quick presentation. And then we're going to hear from Representative Hausman and Dr. Sarah on the very big proposal for the biomedical science building, and then we'll open it up to questions. Welcome to the committee, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, you have the bill in your packet, too. 262. I'll move that House Bill 262 be Representative Moe moves House Bill 262 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Ed and Workforce Development bonding bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I don't think we need to take a lot of your time. Because
you're not going to.
That's good. It's a win-win for all of us.
Yes.
But this was in the bonding bill last year, and I'm going to just cut it short and introduce Bill Denny, who's the Executive Director of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. I'm lucky to have it in Roseville and near my house, but truly it serves counties and people and animals from all over the state. It's a pretty exciting place to visit. I suspect a lot of you that are on the bonding committee have been there. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will ask Mr. Denny to give us a short reason why we need this money.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Representative Greiling, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's a pleasure for me to be here today to tell you just a little bit more about WRC. And I want to highlight just a few things from the package. You do have, I think it was passed out earlier, a blue handout that has a variety of different pieces in it. But what I really want to focus on today is about our origins at the University of Minnesota and our continued connection with the University of Minnesota in professional education. The Wildlife Rehab Center started in 1979 as a student organization of the University of Minnesota Veterinary College. We treated about 40 patients in that first year. We shared space with the Raptor Center, 4-H, and in the old anatomy building. Over time, we grew out of that space, and in 1997, our organization legally separated from the university and was chartered as an independent 501c3 organization, although we have maintained an affiliation agreement with the university's veterinary school. And in fact, the dean of the vet school is on our board of directors. We remained on campus for a little while. In the meantime, our building was partially condemned, and we started in 2000 a search for a new fight, and we ended up at, as Representative Greiling said, on a, in a land lease in the city of Roseville, adjacent to the Herod Alexander Nature Center. We have paid for most of our building with private fundraising efforts. About 80% of our building has been paid through those private fundraising efforts. There are really five main reasons why we think that this is a, an organization of statewide significance that deserves your support. They're in that handout, and I urge you to read that. But I do want to focus first primarily on our professional education programs and also our public access. We're the only publicly available facility in the state that's licensed to handle all animals, all species of wild animals. About 80% of all the wild animals that are treated in the state of Minnesota come to WRC. And our, the demand for our services is frankly outstripping our ability to pay for it. We've had a 25% increase in the demand of our services since 2003. In 2007, more than 5,000 people brought us animals from 234 communities around the state. And that was from 50 different counties. We've even had wild animals brought to us all the way from the range that were injured. And
were they legislators?
Our patients we can actually rehab.
You might get an extra $100,000 for that one. President Brunick, take notes on that. So.
We like to say that the Wildlife Rehab Center is really the state of Minnesota and the university's veterinary hospital for wild animals, but we're funded entirely by private donations. And the area that I think is probably most important for this committee is the role that we play statewide, in fact, nationally, in professional education. In the past few years, the veterinarians at WRC have begun to play a prominent role in wildlife medicine. And wildlife medicine is a rapidly growing field of interest in veterinary schools, yet there's almost no curriculum that's available to teach wildlife medicine. And to address this, about 3 years ago, WRC and the College of Veterinary Medicine at the university developed a series of initiatives to help introduce and teach wildlife medicine to vet students. You know, even if they don't go directly into this field, and after all, I've got two jobs in my place for veterinarians, and there's not a whole lot of demand across the country for these jobs, nearly everybody who's in the veterinary community is going to have some connection with wild animals through their clients, because after all, most of us, when we think of animals, we think of our veterinarians. The areas that we're particularly excited about is we do have a program where first and second year students can actually volunteer at our organization for 14 weeks during the summer, and they earn academic credits for that work with us. We also have the final year veterinarians who spend 2 to 6 weeks working with us as part of their rotation. There's a couple of other things that I would hope that you can look at when you take some time to look at that one handout. The other piece that I should tell you is that our veterinarians are adjunct faculty at the university. So I think those are important things. And finally, I'll just close by saying we do an important role in disease surveillance as well, and we're currently participating with the Raptor Center and the university in terms of the NIH grant that was recently granted, where we're actually doing crop swabs and the blood samples of some of our patients to make sure that there aren't any wildlife diseases that spread to the human population. So as I understand it, your time is short, and I will just close for any questions.
Questions of Representative Grimey or Mr. Kennedy? Thank you very much. Then I guess Representative Mahoney. Oh, we already moved. That's right. Okay. And Representative Bly, do you want to go up since you're...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Representative Bly moves House Bill 2557. He recommended a pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bonding bill. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chairman. This is a bill that would authorized spending to acquire a center building as land buildings and other improvements of a capital nature, authorizing issue of state bonds for a dairy facility at the University of Minnesota West Central Research Outreach Station. Organic and dairy product demand is increasing at a rate of 20-25% per year. Currently, 5% of milk consumed is produced on farms certified under the national organic standard. The mature market penetration is unknown, but Denmark, for example, organic milk has reached 50% of fluid milk consumption. Organic dairy farmers have few sources of science-based information in the United States. Currently, organic dairy research and teaching activities are located at the University of New Hampshire, Chico State University in California, the University of Minnesota West Central Research and Outreach Center's Dairy Research and Outreach Program is focused on dairy farming systems that emphasize sustainability through grazing, minimal housing, crossbreeding, and group rearing. It is well positioned to add the added value impact of organic production with relatively modest adjustments to management. It could become a center for multiple benefits, dairying that confronts the challenges of capital investment, energy supply and emissions, food quality and quantity, manure as fertilizer, profitability, rural population infrastructure, animal welfare, global warming, landscape expectations, and water quality. Changes need to implement a conversion to certified organic include upgrading a 15-year-old milk center for a 70-cow organic herd and 90-cow conventional herd of comparison. A number of the farmers in my district are small farmers, and a number of them are organic farmers, and they would see this as a great value to their work. Also, I think, as we saw in the clip, the West Central Research Facility deals with energy and the changing energy environment, and this would be a way of looking at conservation as well, moving agriculture away from its heavy dependence on petrochemicals. And it's also, organic farming is also becoming a excellent tool for startup farmers who want to start small businesses, and we believe that this could be accomplished with minimal investment and big results, and reach big results. One other piece in the bill is following up on money that we budgeted in the Ag Special for about $400,000 that would increase commitment to sustainable and organic agriculture, and we kind of like to know what the plans are for that, and perhaps in question when we get questions to the university, I'll follow up on that.
Thank you, Representative Blyan. This assumes a 33%, one-third match.
Yes.
Questions that Representative Blyan. Okay. Representative Hausman and Dr. Sarah. The big kahuna. President Bruning is coming again. Do we get a slideshow here too, or a movie?
No.
I was going to go get some popcorn if that was the case. Representative Hausman, welcome. Members, this is what we're going to do with this bill. This is the only time we're going to hear it. And we don't have a bill in front of us, and I'm not going to have this bill come through because I just don't think we have time. So this bill, when it gets numbered, will be referred directly to the bonding committee. That's why we're seeing it as a non-numbered bill and questions out of this committee, because there are some questions, and we will have to carry the debt in this committee. Whoever has it years from now will be carrying the debt as it's proposed. Representative Hall.
And Mr. Chair, I am very grateful to you for your willingness to do that, though the bill is not yet before you. This was a recent idea, though not a new commitment to bioscience initiatives, as you well know from Representative Mahoney and Representative Norton and others. Mr. Chair, I believe you and Representative Hahn had a hearing about a week ago in which you asked the question, is Minnesota losing its competitive edge? And there was a newspaper account of that hearing that included these numbers. Minnesota has fallen behind on academic research and development spending. And then in that hearing, apparently Tom Stinson held up a 2007 U of M study entitled Long Gone Lake Wobegon, showing that between 1972 and 2004, Minnesota fell in state rankings to number 19 to number 26 for total academic research and development spending. and from number 20 to number 40 for per capita academic R&D spending. That tends to catch your attention. And many of us, of course, have heard the university's requests over the last 2 years that Representative Mahoney brought before us. But we always struggled. It wasn't that the legislature lacked knowledge on the importance of this field, but we struggled with how does it fit within the debt service guidelines that we have and that we need to balance with so many other needs, from clean water infrastructure to corrections to all of the other issues. So what is coming today is a new idea, a new approach, where we do not state bonding, but university bonding. And when this new idea came to us, it moved us to say instead, not what can't be done, but what can be done. What can be done, and in fact, hearing these statistics, how fast can we do it? And members, I will tell you, I am quite excited about the possibilities that are before us. And this will be a very big deal nationally. As we begin to talk about this, this will be one of those stories as we reach out to all of the states and all of those research and development stars that we hope to come here. It will, I believe, make many people in the country pay attention to what is happening here in the area of research and development. So we're grateful for your willingness, and I don't know who is, I'm going to just pull aside because we need to describe this, the method, and then what we can do about it.
Chair, we're convening. Let me just make a couple of really quick comments, and then I'm going to ask Senior Vice President Sarah and Vice President Sittenreiter, our Vice President for Finance, to come in and explain the proposal. I want to thank Representative Alex Houseman for serving as chief author on the bill and making this presentation to you today, and Representative Mahoney, who really carried this discussion in the Minnesota House last year, and along with Representative Norton. I think it was not only a discussion of the bill, but it was a discussion of how these profound changes in our world are important to the future of the University of Minnesota and our state. The statistic on 40th and per capita R&D spending, state spending, is a pretty dismal statistic, and it's one that, quite frankly, we have to address in the state of Minnesota. I think that may be the topic for another conversation. But we can't be competitive in the world economy unless we pay attention to this particular sector that we're going to talk about here today. I mentioned earlier that this year, university researchers brought in close to $620 million of outside funding, and they compete with the very best scientists in the world for that funding. Much of it also developed in a partnership, or some of it developed in a partnership with Mayo Clinic. And just to put this in perspective, according to the Department of Commerce, that $620 million creates about 25,000 jobs, not just at the University of Minnesota, but in Minnesota's private economy. And that doesn't calculate the jobs that are created through innovation. When I was on the Iron Range about 2 weeks ago, we talked about E.W. Davis's work over 35 years developed taconite and transformed the economy of northern Minnesota. That's what research and development can do. And in the global economy, that's Minnesota's competitive edge. Now, just to put this in perspective, according to the people we've consulted with and some really hard-nosed data in this area, Minnesota already is blessed, unlike many other states, with perhaps the second most vibrant biomedical research industry and device industry in the entire world. It employs about 250,000 people today in Minnesota. And it's an industry where the employment has actually grown about 30% over the last 10 to 12 years. This is an industry that is global. It is very easy to lose. And it's also an industry that we can grow here in the state of Minnesota. About 20 states around the country are making very, very deep investments in this area. About 3 years ago, we came forward to the Minnesota legislature with this idea to create a vision in biomedical science, with a vision that we believe will advance science, advance human cures, create a lot of dynamic activity in Minnesota's economy, a great expansion of public-private partnerships that I think this state really vitally needs. And this is happening in many, many other states. States that are looking across the fence at Minnesota and saying to themselves, I wonder if we could be the next Minnesota. And our argument is, if they're willing to make this kind of investment, we ought to be willing to make the investment necessary to keep our great industries and to actually grow them. And increasingly, the R&D in this area, the basic science that is driving these discoveries that Vice President Sarah can talk to you about, is coming from our great universities, public and private, across the world. Give you some examples. University of California, San Francisco, spending $1.5 billion in capital investment in this area in a short period of time. University of Minnesota, University of Wisconsin-Madison, $750 million. And they don't have the kind of industrial base economic capacity that we have. New York, $250 million. North Carolina, $275 million. Oklahoma, $475 million. California, $3 billion, and I could go on and on. So we think this is a visionary idea. It's an idea that I think has great potential to create employment, economic activity in Minnesota. But most importantly, I think it's an idea that really can cure some of the most devastating diseases that we have in our population and in populations around the world. Let me ask Senior Vice President Sarah at this time to explain the Biomedical Sciences Research Program and the buildings that we're recommending to you over this period of time.
Thank you, Mr. President, Mr. Chair of the Committee, welcome. Representative Hausman. I'm going to start where President Brudich led off with something that's hot off the press of the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And the reason it's relevant is two. The reason. One, this is the site of a university that's quite a ways behind us in the development of biomedical sciences and biotechnology. The second reason it's important is this. This plan is put forth by one of my closest friends, Dr. Bart Chernow, whom I've worked with for over 30 years, and let me tell you, there's no moss under this guy's feet. And they are planning a 1.4 million square feet development in the biosciences. You can figure that kind of stuff goes at $500 a square foot. They're going to catch us if we don't go. I think that's the message that delivers. So what you have in front of you on these screens is our plan for finishing these next four investment facilities over the next 5 to 6 years. We can build them, we can populate them with the faculty that do the work in a way that will greatly enhance our state's research capacity and will actually ensure the state a future as a powerhouse in biotechnology. The important thing is not the bricks and mortar. The important thing is what the faculty do inside it. Each of these facilities has a thematic basis that brings together from across the university disciplines to promote biotechnology. Disciplines in engineering, disciplines in cognitive science in the College of Liberal Arts, disciplines in physics and engineering and biology along with health science. This is truly a way of leveraging the university's core assets. The first of these is the Center for Magnetic Resonance Imaging. Right now, this center, which we refer to as CMRR, is acknowledged by all to be the world's finest. What they do here is they develop new imaging techniques for non-invasive diagnostics and therapeutics. A couple examples. There's now coming out a new non-invasive way to diagnose Alzheimer's disease so we don't have to do brain biopsies. Those kinds of things. This particular facility is worked in by over 500 faculty from across the university. If it is to remain the best place in the world and attract and retain the best faculty in these areas, it needs to be expanded. This new expansion will house 10 principal investigators, we refer to as PIs, and will cost $53.2 million and can be completed by 2010. Completed means move in. The second facility we call the Cancer Biomedical Research Building. This is where our National Cancer Institute Comprehensive Designated Cancer Center would continue its long history of developing cures. For example, the cure for childhood leukemia was developed here, and the bone marrow transplantation that is done across the world is based on this research and the protocol. This would house 40 PIs, would cost $85 million, and would be completed and moved in by January 2012. The third building is the Lilly High Biomedical Research Building. The best way I can explain to you what happens in this building is to refer you back to what you all saw Doris Taylor on TV for, Professor Taylor. The skeleton of a heart was repopulated with beating alive muscle, heart muscle cells. A whole new horizon of biomedical research, organ development, etc., has happened. This building would house 40 PIs, would cost $86.1 million, and would be completed and moved in July 2012. The final building is slated for infectious disease and neuroscience. The way I can give you an idea of this is to make you aware of Professor Paul Bohannon's work. Paul Bohannon is an infectious disease expert who has researched a way to turn immune systems on and off. If you have rheumatoid arthritis, your immune system needs to be turned off. If you have an organ transplant, it needs to be turned off. It's important switches go in the right direction. If you can't fight off infections, it needs to be turned on. The other interesting piece of this is this created a whole new discipline across Washington Avenue because the computational scientists and the Institute of Technology developed the methodologies for Professor Bohannon and the medical school to do this research. That's what's really exciting about this kind of leverage. That would house 30 PIs, cost $67.7 million, and would be moved in by July 2013. Now, something you should know.
Representative Mahoney, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me, and I know you want to go through all the way to the end of the question, but if I might ask, how many people come with each PI in terms of research assistance?
That was the next sentence.
Oh, good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, thank you for asking this question. Each principal investigator comes with four investigators, and each associate investigator comes with six staff. Let me do the math. If you take the 120 new direct hires, when you multiply all that out for the PIs, times 24 personnel, which is 6 times 4, you get 2,880 direct hires by the time we move into the last building. If you add the indirect effect of that, using the NIH's numbers of about 40 per $1 million of new NIH money, you come out with a little more than 4,000. If you add in some of the other economic development, our conservative estimate is 4,800 new jobs by the time this last building is populated. That goes along with other outcomes of a minimum of $100 million of new NIH federal money coming into the state. What it's already doing is beginning to attract venture money and real estate development money for the development of more things like enterprise laboratories, accelerators, places for new startup companies, and our ability to remain competitive in the biotechnology industry is greatly enhanced by that capacity. We also fully expect a new technology for commercialization and new ways to prevent and treat disease. Now,
but I just want to, Mr. Chairman, I want to introduce Vice President Pittenreiter, who will make a few comments about how the bill is structured and how financing is structured.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just real quickly, the legislation itself will establish a Minnesota biomedical research program that will provide funding for the four research facility projects that Dr. Sarah just discussed. It creates an 80-20 financing partnership between the state of Minnesota and the university to pay for the construction of each one of those projects. It caps the state contribution at $233.6 million, that's 80%, and requires the university to fund $58.4 million, so the total construction cost of these buildings would be $292 million. It requires or establishes that the university, not the state of Minnesota, but the university, issues this $292 million worth of bonds, and the legislation establishes an annual appropriation, a maximum annual appropriation relating to the state's contribution of $233.6 million. So it is important for the committee to understand that this bill will authorize an annual appropriation that ramps up over the next 5 years and then would ramp for 25 years and slowly come down at the end of that 25-year period. And that appropriation then pays the debt service on the bonds issued by the University of Minnesota. It's a fairly simple and straightforward concept. This is not bonds that the state of Minnesota issues. It's an appropriation you provide the University of Minnesota to retire that debt that we issue.
Okay. Members, questions, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions I always have, and I'm not sure who should answer this, maybe it's you know, in the name of retaining competitiveness and going forward and so on, I'm interested in two things in terms of our university. One is, what's the benefit to the consumer? I've asked several times in various committees, when we invest public money in biotech, what guarantee, and I've never really seen any sort of guarantee come forward, do we have that the products that are made are affordable to the average Minnesotan? So, for example, some of the very expensive kind of aids that are out there are wonderful, but, you know, considering our current medical system, a lot of them are not in the reach of many people. And so that's one question that I've asked repeatedly and I still don't have an answer to. Second one is... we're giving the university new bonding authority, it looks like, and the university has to raise private money to match this in this bill, right? And the private money, what I want to know is...
Or appropriate indirect costs off the increased grants that come in or other internal resources, but we would try very, very hard to raise private money to cover as much as possible.
Right. And so... one of the things in the interest of good and objective science, I want to make sure that when we raise those private dollars that we still have objective science and that we're not, you know, in the, putting a, you know, a price on, I mean, over the years, I guess I just want to say, and this isn't a new issue you've ever heard from me, but over the years, we certainly have had reports from the kinds of science that people, you know, scientists, our university scientists have to become entrepreneurs to get their work done. And that means they have to get contracts, you know, from some of the companies that we now know cause very serious health problems, like Monsanto's of the world, for example, providing money to some pesticide research. What kind of objectivity do we still have? So that's the kind of question I just want to put out there. I have it, had it for years, and I really don't really still have an answer. Now, as we give more independence to the university to bond, the question rises to a higher level for me. So that's why I'm raising it.
President.
Madam Chairman, Representative Clark, these are really good questions. Let me start with the second one. I would anticipate any private fundraising would mostly come from individuals. Secondly, the university has very, very strict protocols adopted by our Board of Regents to make sure that we do not get into gifts of this kind that creates the conflict of interest you've noted. And there's no guarantees that something couldn't happen in the future, but I can tell you our record in this area has been pretty good. And we really work hard to make sure we walk away from a gift in a heartbeat if we think it has any strings attached that would limit our ability to pursue the questions that we really think are important. And I think that's the way it should be. One of the best guarantees you have that the university will keep its commitment to the highest levels of integrity is to have a state partnership. I think where you have the greatest problem is where you don't have a compelling state interest, where the state isn't engaged in raising these serious questions that you just articulated a moment ago. I'll just say one other quick thing about question number one, which is what's the benefit for consumers? What I think is really, I am not from biomedical sciences, my background in social sciences, but when I look at the evolution of work, much of the work is focused on a very, very important consumer-oriented issue. For example, the leading researchers in the area of preventing type 1 diabetes are at the University of Minnesota. We're deeply proud of their work. It's one of the great signature areas of the University of Minnesota. 10% of the healthcare costs in the United States. The research is all about helping develop therapies that enable the human body to treat itself. And that's a far more cost-effective approach than I think the high-technology medicine approaches with heavy use of pharmaceuticals with all the side effects that we all know about. I hospitalized my late father more because of drug effects than I even did for the diseases that he was struggling to combat. And so I think there are some real issues here. But my sense is a lot of this work is precisely designed to bring down these healthcare costs, make sure that healthcare is more accessible and affordable. But there are no guarantees that each and every project will have that kind of beneficial outcome, but that's clearly the intent of the University of Minnesota. Let me just let Frank add a couple of comments.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I do recall receiving this question from you last year at this hearing. I'm going to tell two stories, quick ones. Vice President Mulcahy and I were struggling with a relationship with a private company in Minnesota for the last 2 weeks. Multi-million dollar deal on the table. It came down to negotiating a result, and the company wanted control over publication of the data. We declined the relationship and turned it down. That's just an example of both the policy and the ethos, I think, that the university puts on the table when it comes to these kind of relationships, and it happens all the time. We go out of our way to try and form these relationships, but there are certain boundaries and lines in the sand. Number two, the pricing of new products, clearly an issue. I appreciate it very dearly on two levels. In my portfolio is the university's health plan. I understand the cost of some of these new medications, and we happen to be fortunate to have a single-payer universal access plan, but I know what it costs. On a personal level, I pay for one of these medications for my diabetes. What's the payoff? I've never been under better control, and I haven't been in the hospital in 6 years. So I think there's a balance. And the other point I would make is there are certain things this university can do, and there are certain it can't. And when it comes to the pricing of drugs, we have no control over that. We just don't. We can't do that kind of thing. We can work with new startups. We can work with companies to try and make them have socially responsible relationships. But ultimately, that's a business in a free marketplace, the way the healthcare system is currently set up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate both of your thoughtful responses. I just want to say, though, back to in response to your last question, your last comment, it seems to me that the creative minds there could figure out ways, and I actually had language a couple of years ago that would have provided incentives for lowering the price of to the consumer, to, you know, making these products more accessible to, I represent a lot of low-income people. They're not going to be the folks who are going to be necessarily covered by the kinds of insurance that they would need to be covered by to get access to some of the kinds of, new products. So, to me, there was language, I could pull it out again, Mr. Chairman, that basically said when the university or any, in this case, when the university provides, the subsidy, this is public subsidy, to a private-public partnership, that then there's some agreement or there's some incentive for helping ensure the affordability of those products. And that's all I'm talking about at this point. I mean, I do have concern about some of the protocols we could miss maybe another time, but at least in terms of incentives for affordability, I guess I'd ask you to think about that, and we could look at some language again. It could be friendly language, but I think it would be... it makes a lot of difference to make...
Chair, Representative Clark, I remember the language because I thought about it a lot, and I think it is the basis for some good dialogue, but I truly believe this is a problem the healthcare marketplace and its regulators and policymakers need to solve. For the university to be the person that solves that problem does not have a large likelihood of success. That's my personal belief.
Mr. Kennedy, my only comment is when there's public subsidy involved, then it becomes not a marketplace issue. I mean, if the marketplace doesn't need the subsidy, that's one thing, but if it does, then we have a responsibility.
Members, other questions on the Representative Mark?
Thank you, Chair. It's a two-part question, I guess. One is, you've given us an earlier presentation with a list of priorities and then this very exciting proposal, which is coming back from last year and perhaps prior years. Where does this fit in your list of priorities, or does it, would be one of my questions. And the second is, I don't think I heard you mention, I think the original proposal was 6 buildings, one might be underway, and then these are the 4, where they're going to be. We've just come from a really exciting presentation down in Representative Poppy's area. I think many of you were there. The Hormel Institute, which is part of the University of Minnesota. I guess I wondered, are these all the University of Minnesota Minneapolis campus, or will these perhaps be elsewhere? So those are my two questions.
I can answer that question. They're all at the University of Minnesota campus. But the first question is an interesting one. Go ahead, President.
Chairman, Representative Norton, it's a difficult question in many ways. First of all, the highest priority for the University of Minnesota in this 2008 session is our capital bill, the first presentation we made. I think we wouldn't be doing our job if we didn't present the urgent need for the university to invest long-term in this area. I think the stakes are really very high. And the problem you have when you use the capital bonding process every 2 years is we have little or no certainty that the bill will be funded. There is little ability to plan long-term. This is a long-term economic development investment on the part of the state of Minnesota. Incidentally, we issue the bonds and the state would provide an annual appropriation under this revised procedure for helping us retire a significant portion of the debt. But I think the important thing to remember is you cannot be competitive in growing your presence and your impact in biomedical sciences unless you take a long-term view. You have to look out 6 to 10 years. You have to plan in a 6 to 10 year horizon. You have to have predictability in the investment. And or otherwise, you have little or no ability to keep your very best people or to compete for the best people around the world. That's the dilemma you have. Now, these buildings would be on the Twin Cities campus, as Representative Rukavina mentioned, but I should say that the university's overall strategy is statewide. Now, we're joining with Hormel to build a very big expansion down there. They raised a lot of the local capital, but we've got a lot of skin in the game, too. We've got a good deal of the investment on the ground. We greatly expanded the investment and the scientists that are necessary to fill that building and get the job done. There's also a partnership with Mayo Clinic that is a part of this expansion. And there are other parts of the state where we're doing similar things. But the capital bonding bill, with all the other needs of the University of Minnesota is not a bill that can really accommodate this long-term vision. We'd have to make one of these buildings the top priority for the University of Minnesota and crowd out every one of our other academic needs statewide to get this job done over the next few years. And it is a real challenge. How is Minnesota going to stay competitive in the world economy? It's got to make these kinds of investments. We think this is a very cost-effective way to leverage the state's investment, and we think it's the right thing to do, and we think it's the right mechanism to bring forward for your consideration.
Before I call on Representative Mahoney, I just want to say a few things, and that is, you know, that this is, you know, Mr. Spitzenritter, I don't want to put you on the spot, but at one time you were the chief fiscal analyst, Ron, you're like Mr. Marx is, and I can only imagine what you would have said about this. Look me in the eye and tell me you would have, I won't do that to you. Members, this money is going to, you know, be with this committee one way or another, carried in the base, and you see the price tag on page 3 here. So, Representative Hausman, I've told you that if I had my feelings, or my way, I would, and we don't have a bill to amend, but I would probably, you know, move to on page 2 to line 2.18 to delete 20% and put one-third back in. And then on the last page on line 3.14, I would probably eliminate in the University of Minnesota policy, because I think you could help the university. First of all, I think as the wherewithal to raise the one-third, Minsky has to do it. I know this is a difference, you know, comparing apples to oranges maybe, but I think you have the wherewithal, President Brunas, to do that. And even during the last year, members, if you recall, Representative Norton and Welty, when we talked about the Defiant Genomics Project, what, if anything, was discovered, it would be shared with the rest of the state of Minnesota, and that in the way of royalties or moving jobs or whatever. So, you know, that would be the second part of it. But I understand, and I think everybody at this table does, President Brunick, the importance of this proposal. But, you know, we have a governor that seemed to me to be spending a lot of money yesterday, but doesn't, he got a penny was leaving around. And, you know, these things, you can see how expensive they are. Plus, we have the whole tuition. We did a pretty good job last year, but who knows what the forecast is going to be and what we're going to be asked as a committee to possibly cut, which I don't think I'm going to do it. Somebody else is going to have to take over this gavel to do that, because I'm not going to. That's the problem we have, and, you know, I had tried to be as fair to both systems as possible last year with appropriations, tried to keep it in balance, because they do educate a lot more students at a Minsky system than the university. And this might get us a little out of whack. We're carrying the stadium dollars in the base, I believe, and we're carrying the money we got in the out years at Rochester. So I'm just throwing that out there for everybody to think about. It will be discussed as the bill moves forward. Representative Mahoney, I don't know, do you want to comment, or Representative Mahoney go first, and then we got a little time. President Brunick, you can. And we got Representative Welty. Go ahead, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will not just thank the President, but I will thank the whole university for coming in and bringing this forward. You know, Representative Norton asked what place the priority for the university this particular project was. And members, this is not something I have just started working on. I've been following this for 4 or 5 years, and I have spent more time than is probably my constituents probably want to know, following the biomedical, the university and its program. I'm going to say thank you to the university because this is the first, this is really in 10 years at the Capitol, this is the first time I have seen someone think about job creation large. This is a vision for not 2 or 3 years. This is a vision, as a governor that I have come to respect more and more, Governor Perpich, would think large. He didn't think small. He thought Mall of America, and whether I like the Mall of America is irrelevant here. He thought, how can we create a long-term, viable future for the state of Minnesota? We have a medical device industry, and we have wonderful, wonderful companies that work in it. We have the workforce. We have the scientists that work in it. But that is only one aspect. These five buildings that will be, the four that are here and the fifth that is being made, is being put into place right now, expands this. It's not just something you put into your heart to keep it beating. This creates a new heart. This creates and repairs pancreases. This spawns small companies. This is a company in the last few years that have been sold for anywhere from small companies that were started with some of the ideas that come from this kind of research. Anything from $7 million in purchase price to $350 million. And not just employ one or two people, but employ 1,000 or 100 employees with really, really good paying jobs. So to the whole university, I want to say thank you for not thinking small, for not asking for a little, but asking for a lot. This is my grandchildren's future. This is not my future. So thank you.
Representative Welty. We have to get off pretty quick, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to President Brunick and to the other testifiers. First of all, I just want to thank you for having the long-term vision and putting together, I think, a good list of capital requests. In southeastern Minnesota, last week, Representative Norton and I went to the celebration where essentially IBM is kind of partnering up with the Hormel Institute with the new Blue Gene computer. And I understand it's the first supercomputer in that region. And actually, I think in the state of Minnesota, it's the first supercomputer. So we're making great progress down there. But I ended up taking a tour of Hormel Institute, and I've been hearing about this for a couple of years, that this is my first time to get down there, and they're building the new building. And we took the tour, and we learned about how you get one good researcher to come, and you find out how many staff or how many other scientists come along with that one researcher. And I really see a great deal of potential at the Hormel Institute. And the Hormel Institute is a new addition that's funded mainly by the foundation and private dollars that are being leveraged. Also in southeastern Minnesota, of course, we have the partnership now between the University of Minnesota and Mayo with the genomics research. And I've seen how we've been able to lure in top-notch researchers. And I really think that we have invested our dollars in the state of Minnesota wisely. We've taken a few dollars and we invested them wisely. Not like some of the other states where they're putting in $750 million or $1 billion and they're putting this large amount of money out there and they're saying, all right, now let's build. We're strategically doing that here in the state. I want to thank you for joining and developing this partnership. But as I look down your list of the 2008 capital requests, my first question is this a priority list? And then my second question is, if it is a priority and the University of Minnesota wants to get to the top three in the United States as far as research universities, then why does lab renovations and classroom improvements fall further down the list than some of the other things that are ranked above it? And I know you go through this and every 2 years you come here and projects move up and down, but as I see it, we need more labs, we need better labs. And in the video clip, they talked about how important labs are. So I appreciate your comments on that.
Chair Rukavina, first of all, I want Representative Welty, first of all, I want to thank Representative Mahoney for his eloquent comments. I don't think he could have stated the case any better, certainly than we could. He stated it better than we could, and I want to thank you for that. Let me get back to your question about...
Can I interrupt you for just 1 second? Because I am going to move members before everybody sees all of the bills that we heard for the Minsky system. the sheet that you have, I believe, still in your packet, House File 973 through Representative Nelson's House File 891 for possible inclusion in the in our higher education workforce development bonding bill that we'll recommend. So are there any questions on that? You know the list. We heard them on Tuesday. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. And then I will move the other two bills that aren't on the or that are on this list here. House File 2761, which is Representative Hausman's Bell Museum bill, which is on the list, and House File 1964, which is Representative Westham's bill, which is also on the one of the research buildings on the final line here on the capital request plan. Any questions on that motion? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Sorry, Mr. President. Go ahead.
Representative Welty, these are listed in priority order. I think you have to dig deeper and consider that as a separate issue, and then consider the buildings below it, buildings and other projects below it in priority order. To make a couple of quick comments, in the last couple of cycles, we have made biomedical science investments a major part of our bills, and they have been built, including the joint facility in Rochester between involved research involving the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota. These are absolutely foundational projects for a whole range of reasons. The science teaching building, for example, provides the first 2 years of coursework for about 50 majors on the Twin Cities campus, and it's foundational for all of these fields we're talking about. In medicine and in so many other fields as well, civil engineering. So this is a very, very heavily oriented bill toward improving science education, as I mentioned in my remarks. The Bell Museum of Natural History is a great place of education, not just for K-12 education. We should be proud of the fact that we have this great Museum of Natural History. It was given to the University of Minnesota for the management of the museum in the 1800s, just literally hundreds of people have given to try to given to the university to realize their dream. About $10 million have been raised over about a 7 to 9 year period. We just felt that since we offer 33 classes roughly in this building, it's foundational to all the environmental science programs and land use programs that involve the University of Minnesota departments, that this was really a priority that we couldn't wait. Three presidents have promised people if they went out there and raised the money, we'd get the job done. And it is a vital center of research and education at the University of Minnesota. So we tried to list these in sort of order of urgency and importance. It doesn't mean that classrooms and laboratories are less important. If we don't get some funding from the legislature to help us in that area, we're going to have to scramble in a lot of different ways, at least to keep things going. But the other buildings just that are higher in this list are just more urgent, serve more people, and have more critical and urgent needs associated with them. You know, Fowl's over 100 years old, and we raised our own money. We cannibalized our own budget to stabilize the outside of the facility because we were worried about leaky roofs and damaging just a priceless building. And that was done in the last couple of years because the heat request wasn't big enough to cover it, and we just basically felt we couldn't wait. And if we waited, we'd have a bigger bill to pay somewhat downstream. So these are always hard things to juggle. Vice Chair of the Board, Clyde Allen, used to be Commissioner of Revenue, and he likes to, in meetings, take a back of the envelope and do calculations. And when I talked about a $100 million investment in HEPR, which seems like an enormously large number, he calculated that if we got every dollar of that $100 million this year, 2 years from now, 2 years beyond that, we could get around to every one of our buildings once every 30 years. Think about fixing your roof every 30 years. Think about taking care of the internal infrastructure every 30 years. And it's not just the university's problem. It's MNCU's problem as well. And this is part of that human capital infrastructure that the state really needs to address. And in my judgment, paying attention to that is just as important as many of the other needs of the state. I'll just finish on one note. You probably noticed that I came out and argued very strongly that we needed to get some of the transportation funding out of the capital bill. I'm not an expert on taxation, but I do believe that we ought to have dedicated revenues and not cannibalize the capital bill, as I think we're doing at the present time. I spoke out on it. The reporter thought it was a unique story because the president of the University of Minnesota has difficulty walking and chewing gum at the same time. We talked about tax policy. And,
but you dress nice. Mr.
Yeah, but I do. And I just should say that it appeared in the Star Tribune opposite the obituary page, so I really don't know what to make of it. I'm hoping that you'll at least consider those issues as well, because I must tell you, as a long-term resident of Minnesota and a person who plans to retire and die here, I'm deeply concerned about the future of our state. And I think now is the time to invest, and I don't think we have very much time here, or we're going to find ourselves. I always use this comment. I used it in my Range speech just the other day. In 1959, this state was 29th in per capita income. We're now in the top 10. We're slipping. And it's these kinds of investments that really make a difference. These are the long-term investments. They're the easiest ones to cut from NINCURE of the University of Minnesota. But these are the investments that support the education and development of people, and that's the key to the new economy. More today, more tomorrow, more next year than ever before. So that's not part of my remarks, but I know This committee did absolutely stellar work on behalf of NINCURE and the University of Minnesota. You really stretched. You raised $50 million beyond the governor's recommendation last year. I told a group of private donors that we would have to raise a $1 billion endowment to make up for what you did in a single year in adding to the base budget of the University of Minnesota. And I hope you stay strong in your commitment not to cut us.
I'm not going to be the one to do it, Mr. President. I can tell you that. Representative Hausman, you want to wrap it up?
Yes,
we're really late.
I will. And just to be absolutely clear, because Representative Clark said earlier we're granting the university new authority. I want to be very clear. We're not giving them new authority to bond. They have always had this authority. In fact, it is the same authority they used for the stadium. And we nudged them a little bit and said, could you use that same authority for this purpose? And to just respond to Representative Norton, so in other words, this is, we're advancing the same kind of research, but with a different mechanism. And this mechanism allows us to say, with state bonds, we have to determine this other set of building priorities. But on this, it is the university's bonding authority that is set aside for it. But most important, I want to say a
Representative
word of defense.
I'm getting the evil eye from Representative Kahn.
I want to say a word of defense of Frank Serra, who I know will be there and is reform-minded, because he and I had a conversation. I happen to believe we have put too much stuff between the patient and the doctor. Lots of private companies and all of this. And I was telling a story that he heard that I said to a group of physicians, you've got to lead the revolution. And we had a conversation subsequently, he may not recall this, where he asked me to recount that story because he said it is in fact one of those things they need to think about teaching physicians, how to advocate for their patients over against all of this bureaucracy that we policymakers have set up.
I just don't picture him as Che Guevara, but reading that. Representative Hausman, I think we're going to have to go.
Thank you very much.
Members, Monday night. Remember Monday night. Meeting adjourned.